Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, the independent republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We have reached the end of another lockdown week as we edge ever closer to the Boris Johnson roadmap. On Monday, the Prime Minister will reveal exactly what he's decided to do. Or, alternatively, depending on your view, he will reveal exactly what his sage advisers tell him he can do. We shall explore the options today with Baroness Kate Hoey over in Northern Ireland, where they're still struggling with the fallout from Brexit. Last time we spoke, it wasn't clear what the end result would actually be. It wasn't clear how they would solve the problem of the Northern Ireland Protocol and the intransigence of the European Union. We'll find out whether or not they've got any closer to doing that. We might also ask her what she made of Keir Starmer's rather lacklustre keynote speech yesterday, where he once again failed to make any impression on anyone or anything. It was absolutely dull as ditch water, as you might have expected. Also, he didn't, by the way, mention Brexit. No surprise there. We did a poll yesterday with three possible outcomes. Question was, should Sir Keir Starmer be Prime Minister? The options were no, definitely not, and no chance. Surprisingly enough, 100% of you thought that he would not be Prime Minister. Another fantastic, unbiased poll here at Talk Radio, the home of common sense. Coming up, we're talking to a student group who think they're being ripped off, which of course may be their first lesson in life. Many of them haven't even seen the inside of a lecture theatre, but they're still being charged top whack. Most of them are back at home after paying for a year's worth of accommodation. More evidence that education is now a business. Rather than anything else at all. As ever, we need to hear from you, of course, your stories of lockdown madness, your tales of woe from the front line, of trying to run a business, and just what you are hearing from schools, from employers, and from the community as well. 0344 499 1000. We're going north of the border with Stuart Weir once again to find out just what is happening with the parliamentary inquiry into the Alex Salmond affair. Will he give evidence? Is Nicola Sturgeon under even more pressure? It's all gone a bit mad once more. And we're joined by Kevin O'Sullivan with a look ahead to the weekend and today's virtual G7 meeting, where Joe Biden will for the first time lock horns with the likes of Emmanuel Macron and Boris Johnson, of course. Susie Dent's here as well. She's a lexicographer. She's going to be telling us why so many people have learned a new language, even though you can't go anywhere to speak it. Plus, Lisa Francesca Nand will walk us through what the latest news is from the world of travel. And of course, it's Friday, so it's time for the Perrier Awards, an homage to my brilliance in broadcasting with producer Marta Malagon. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, I can't think of anyone I'd rather talk to on a Friday morning than Baroness Kate Hoey of Lyle Hill and Rathlin, non-affiliated peer, of course, in the House of Lords. Kate, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, let's kick off with Northern Ireland, because Sammy Wilson wrote an interesting piece which you tweeted out yesterday about the latest situation in Northern Ireland. Nothing much seems to have changed, really, since the last time you and I spoke, has it?
No, there's been a lot of talking, both publicly and then behind the scenes as well. And, of course, we've seen the joint chair of the committee come over and, well, Zoom over and talk to industry in Northern Ireland yesterday, talk to people in the Republic of Ireland, talk to civil society. A lot of talking going on. Not sure how much listening and how much action. And next week, the joint committee will meet. I think one of the interesting things that's happened since we last spoke was that Michael Gove is going to be moving on from being the key person involved in the Northern Ireland Protocol. He has chaired it and he's been involved for some time. And now we're getting David Frost, who was the lead negotiator for United Kingdom all during the trade talks. He is coming into the cabinet from the beginning of March and is going to take over that joint chairmanship. And I kind of welcome that because I think I do feel confident that he actually realizes what has to be done. And I'm hopeful that that change will also show the European Union that we are going to be tougher. Mm. And frankly, all this tinkering won't make any difference. What has to change is the actual protocol. And everyone now who's seeing the repercussions of it, even if we fix some of those things, and some probably will get fixed, it still doesn't change the basic premise that the constitutional basis of Northern Ireland has been changed without the consent of people from Northern Ireland. And that's very much against the Belfast Good Friday Agreement.
Well, that's right. And I mean, last time you and I spoke, I think you said Boris Johnson could make this happen without much difficulty if he so wished. Does he feel that David Frost is more likely to be able to deliver that, do you think, than Michael Gove is?
I think he's... The relationship between Boris Johnson and David Frost is very close in the sense that I think he trusts him very much. I'm not saying he doesn't trust Michael Gove, but you never know these days what's going on between the Goveites and the Borisites. Yes. But certainly he trusts David Frost more. And you know, I know people just think, oh, you're just trying to stick up for Boris, but I do genuinely feel that the Prime Minister knows that this was a mistake. It was a mistake that could have been avoided, and it has to be altered because he does not want to go down as the Prime Minister who has caused the first cracks in the breakup of the United Kingdom.
And Sammy Wilson refers to the tensions, and obviously we know the historic tensions in Northern Ireland. Is your sense that has got worse since, say, last week or the week before? Is it getting worse or is it kind of levelling out?
Well, I think the anger is just as great, and indeed even more when people, you know, as a family perhaps, who haven't had much to do with this or taken much interest, suddenly if they're affected by it, if they suddenly can't get something, or they've got a relative who they know is going to have to bring a pet over at some stage, these kinds of little things, but they all add up. So there is anger still there. I think what is worrying, and, you know, I've said this before, is there is a feeling that those who wanted the protocol, those who didn't want a border, who would be the nationalists more or the Republican element in Northern Ireland, they have somehow managed to get more results because of the threats of violence. And that's worrying for a lot of young people from the pro-union community, because many of them will be thinking, well, hang on, we've managed to get nowhere, but then we haven't threatened violence. So, you know, I think that's something that, again, Downing Street needs to be aware of. And I think everyone who cares about peace in Northern Ireland has to recognise that that is also something. The key thing about the Belfast Agreement, it was to bring, you know, stability to Northern Ireland and confidence that nothing could ever change unless there was a majority of people in Northern Ireland who wanted to change it. And that has been completely sort of taken away now. And that's what's worrying.
Yeah. And what about the ports? Are they still operating as if they're not really there, in the sense that anyone who comes in with stuff is allowed to come in?
Well, they're back. The workforce has gone back at the beginning of this week, but there was like quite a long period when lorries were coming in and out without being checked. And as I've always said, you know, the world didn't end, there wasn't any major issue. Right. But now they are back to checking. And of course, things will get worse when the transition period ends and more health certificates have to be brought in. So, you know, it is difficult. And I understand that people, you know, listening in England and perhaps, well, I think particularly England, sort of probably sort of shrug and say, oh, goodness, this not Northern Ireland, who cares, really? And I think that's very, very sad because, you know, Northern Ireland people have put in a huge amount to the United Kingdom over the years. And we deserve to be listened to. And when they say, as all the political parties from the pro-union side are saying, this can't work, then it's got to. Yes. Something has to happen, and it has to happen soon.
Also, I think we have to look at the Northern Ireland situation as part of a round in which, you know, we have a problem in Scotland with the SNP trying to break away from the union. Wales has got its own version of independence that they want to have. And I think, you know, when you put it in that context, it's a much more important story for us.
Well, it's, I think you're absolutely right, Mike, because the links, you know, between Scotland and Northern Ireland, the Ulster Scots sort of aspect is very, very strong. People are very close. There's a lot of movement back and forward between Scotland and Northern Ireland. And, you know, I have no doubt about it that what happens in one part of, you know, what happens in Northern Ireland would affect the thinking in Scotland, and what would happen in Scotland would affect the thinking in Northern Ireland. So the government has now put in, you know, someone who is pushing and supporting the union, you know, to actually portray the benefits of the union generally, the United Kingdom. And that's particularly, of course, in the context of Scotland and the Scottish elections. So I think there is an awareness that maybe we've just taken things for granted for too long, that everything's fine and normal, when actually behind the scenes there's been a lot of movement.
No, you're right. I mean, I've never met more people from Northern Ireland than I met when I was working in Scotland, apart from when I went to Northern Ireland. So, you know, it's very much a sort of a parade of, especially young people who go and study in Scotland and stay and continue to work in Scotland because perhaps the job opportunities are better. And it's,
I forgot to say, Mike, there was the announcement that we might be getting a tunnel between Larne and Stranraer. Now, you know, that's I don't think that was announced to try and take away, you know, the worry about the protocol, because actually it wouldn't make any difference if there was a tunnel there tomorrow. They'd be probably trying to stop the customs check at one end of it. So, but that's interesting, because it would definitely make a huge difference. You know, I get very cross about when, you know, all the people go on about air flying and so on, because if you live in Northern Ireland and you're traveling regularly to England, there's a lot of workers go every Monday morning, come back on Friday or Thursday night. And, you know, to do that by anything other than flying is a mammoth journey.
Yeah.
Either, you know, Liverpool overnight, or you have to go up to Scotland and then take a boat. So, you know, getting a tunnel would be wonderful. Yeah. I'm very supportive of it. But, you know, I'm not someone who understands very much about the building of something like that. And it seems to me to be an amazing project. But, of course, if we did it with the Channel Tunnel, we can do it there.
Well, I think so. And also, there's a guy who has been advocating the building of a bridge, because we spoke to him, I think, some months ago. And one of the impediments, apparently, to it is there's an awful lot of sunken World War II ships in that particular part of the sea, some of which may have unexploded ordnance on them. So, you know, it might be a while before they make that safe. But let's talk about the lockdown.
Yeah, I think...
Go on.
No, I was just going to say, yes, they dumped a lot of ammunition down there. And I think that would have to be very carefully, obviously, looked at before you want to go through a tunnel that's over some ammunition.
Yeah, let's talk about the lockdown. It seems to be sort of fragmenting a little bit, as far as I can see, from one country to another in the union. You know, the Scots have announced that they're going to put some schools back Monday. Boris Johnson, of course, with his roadmap coming out on Monday. Wales have extended their lockdown. I think you guys in Northern Ireland have had an extension to that as well. What's the feeling where you are?
Well, I think you almost feel now that people have just become almost apathetic and accepting that, you know, nothing's going to happen for some time. Yesterday, we got the announcement that our nursery schools and our very first 3 years at primary school would go back on March the 8th. Mm. But the actual lockdown has been extended. We were going to be locked down until the early March. It's now going to be the 1st of April with a review on March the 18th. I think the executive were keen not to have everyone out and around on St. Patrick's Day, March the 17th. But of course, that end of the lockdown, well, it's not the end of the lockdown, it's the announcement of the next discussion about the end of the lockdown, would be just fall before the Easter weekend. And I imagine they will not want people to be out and around at Easter weekend. So I think it's going to come slowly. But they have made a few minor changes. We weren't even allowed click and collect, and that has now been brought back from March the 8th for certain types of goods that are supposedly now essential. Electrical goods have now been brought into that. Baby clothes, some other things. But I think, you know, there's quite a demand for garden centres to be opened again, because this is a time when people want to actually get their garden, you know, projects to grow and put in. So it's a bit depressing, quite honestly, because the weather's depressing. People can't mix in any way whatsoever. But there's no real organised opposition to it. You know, people have begun to accept. What worries me is that they're now using, although the R rate has gone down, they're now using the whole thing about the variant and this terrible variant. Mm. And my worry is that every time we're just about getting back to thinking of moving on, another variant will come and we will end up even without vaccination, yes. You know, even with vaccinations. The vaccination program's gone very well in Northern Ireland.
Well, it's gone very well.
I had my first vaccination.
Okay, good. I mean, it's gone very well in most places, but there are still kind of dichotomies, aren't there? I got an interesting tweet from somebody today who said, you know, so we're told that we can't come out of lockdown despite the fact that vaccinations are working very well. But at the same time, we're told we can't travel anywhere unless you have a vaccination because that will make it safer. And it's like, well, the two things can't both be right.
Yeah, well, I mean, if once people, the most vulnerable have had their second vaccination and the time has passed, then I really can't see that there's any reason why we can't go back to a form of normality with obviously people still being careful. Traveling abroad is always going to be an issue now because it will be depending what's happening in other countries. And, you know, there is a lot of people go to Spain, obviously, from Northern Ireland. There's direct Spanish flights. They're not operating at the moment. But, you know, as soon as that happens, people are going to want to travel. Yeah. And I imagine the vaccination, you know, if you've had your vaccination, that would help. But I imagine that some airlines in some countries will demand it. So it's not really a question of a vaccination passport. I mean, I think what I would really oppose would be anything in this country that you're not allowed to do unless you've had your passport, because that really would be unfair. But I think there's always been issues when you travel abroad about countries demanding certain things, and I don't think we can, you know, do much about that.
No, I think that's right, because of course a lot of young people are now starting to say, well, what's the problem here? Why are you discriminating against us? Because we're not going to get the vaccine until perhaps later in the year, and if you're telling us that we can't do certain things without a vaccine, then you better give it to us.
Well, exactly, and especially for those, you know, young people who've been so badly hit on their education side and then their first jobs and their apprenticeships and all of that, you know, they are the, I mean, it's the very young, that age, the sort of teenage age, and then the very elderly who have really had to bear the brunt of this. There's a lot of people have genuinely gone about their normal business. I mean, you just look at the roads, how busy some of them still are, and the numbers of, you know, I really do admire all the lorry drivers and the van drivers who are out there delivering things, you know, as normal, and they don't seem to get the kind of respect that they should do. They're the people, and the people who work in the supermarkets and so on, that have kept the country going, really, yes. Haven't they?
Well, exactly right. Let's talk a little bit about Keir Starmer. He got up and made his keynote speech yesterday. He managed to talk about the economy without mentioning Brexit, as it was pointed out. It wasn't exactly barnstorming, was it?
No, it wasn't. And I don't think I can never see Sir Keir making a barnstorming speech. That's not his style.
No.
I mean, lawyers do tend, on the whole, to be pretty, oh dear, I'm going to upset people, but be pretty boring sort of people, because they're not necessarily people,
yeah, apart
but
from,
in the way
from,
they deliver.
Apart from Jerry Hayes, I think you'd probably say, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah, well, because he's a one-off, yeah. But no, I think it is difficult for him, if I'm being fair, because, you know, no one's really interested at the moment. They're interested in COVID and they're interested in things to do with, you know, the repercussions of Brexit. And he kind of wasn't even willing to even talk about that. And I didn't really pick up very much about it. I mean, I didn't really understand his bond issue suggestion and how that would differ from some of the things that we've already got. So I think it was just a feeling that he probably had to say something or do something, because there were a few people who were beginning to forget that he was actually the leader of the party.
Yeah. Well, he seems to have run into a kind of, you know, sand pit, if you like, of nothingness, where he can't get any traction really on anything. Even his own party are now beginning to say maybe he was the wrong choice. And you do worry, because as much as I'm not a fan of the Labour Party and haven't really been since the days of Tony Blair, funnily enough, even though everybody seems to now hate Tony Blair. I mean, the Labour Party then was electable, it was sensible, it was able to do things which a lot of people were quite in support of. But you don't want to be in a situation where you have an opposition party that will literally never have a chance of getting into government.
I think the strength of our democracy has always been that we've had a strong government and a strong opposition. Mm. And, you know, in the last number of years, that has kind of drifted away with the coalition government and then, you know, with a very big majority. And if you've got a very big majority, as the government has, it's absolutely crucial that there is a strong, united opposition. And because of the way that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn went and the way that the whole party split over that, split in the sense of being deeply divided, we haven't seen that. I think it's also been very much more difficult because of the restrictions in Parliament to, you know, not to be able to have that sort of roar of support behind him when he's standing up and trying to be, you know, the opposition leader on Prime Minister's Questions. So it is a difficult time for him. But I mean, he hasn't, I think, cut through in the way someone else with a different personality could have. Yeah. And that is worrying. And you're absolutely right. You know, you do need, whatever you think of anybody, any other political party, you do need a good opposition. And certainly the Lib Dems are not going to provide it.
Well, I mean, they've completely disappeared altogether. I mean, if it wasn't for Keir Starmer being probably the most boring politician on earth, you know, Ed Davey would cease to exist. I mean, I don't even know what he does.
I don't think I probably prefer not to talk about Ed Davey or the Lib Dems. I find the way the Lib Dems behaved during the whole of the referendum campaign and the 4 years after was just so despicable, really.
Yes.
That I cannot imagine anyone who voted to leave ever wanting to even think of voting for the Lib Dems again.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Baroness Hoey, as ever, great to talk to you. Have a good weekend with what best you can do things with, because, of course, there's not an awful lot you can do at this moment in time.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, you might think there's a lot of government money going out to help various people who are on furlough, companies who are unable to operate because at the moment they have to close down, hospitality industry, which is being subsidised to a large extent, not in a way which is actually keeping it afloat, by the way, but nevertheless, billions and billions of pounds of government money are being passed out to various sectors of the economy. But not everyone, of course, is actually a beneficiary of what is going on. And we're going to speak now to Mr. Pothole, also known as Mark Morrell, because he's got some news for us on the problems with the roads in this country, because despite the fact that nobody is supposedly going to work, or at least not many, the roads are pretty busy. Mr. Pothole, very good morning to you. Are you there?
Yes, I should be.
Yes, you are now. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks for getting in touch with us. Tell us what's going on out there in the big wide world, because it seems that that local councils, never short of a few bob, are using the pandemic as an excuse not to fix the roads.
I mean, to be fair to them, government promised an extra £2.5 billion over 5 years when we did National Pothole Day last year, which you covered when I went round in an orange tank.
In the tank, yeah, have you still got the tank?
Yeah, in fact, I think they get a bigger one. The roads are that bad, to be honest. We did the same thing this year. I mean, UltraCrate, who sort of worked with me for National Pothole Day, we did a survey because you couldn't go out and do anything grandiose. Mm. So government this week announced £500 million for a pothole fund, and everybody thinks, great, we've had all the MPs jumping on the back of it. In the background, central government have cut £400 million from their maintenance budgets as well. So they've given a bit with one hand and taken a lot away with the other hand. Mm. And at the end of the day, the roads are failing. They keep putting little bits of money in there. I mean, that, to put it in context, that bit of money from a pothole fund isn't enough to actually just carry out the maintenance in Kent itself. Council's under tremendous pressure because of the pandemic, and the social care costs are going up alarmingly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can be their biggest critic, Mike, as you know, and I'm all over them when we get cheap repairs that fail within a week that I get the situation of. But at the end of the day, unless government really take this serious and put into place a long-term investment plan for resurfacing, we will constantly repair potholes, and they're getting worse and worse. And as you said, less traffic around, we're going to get the beast of the east blamed for the situation. The roads are failing through decades of underinvestment. There is an economic argument that it's estimated that badly maintained roads cost this country £5 billion a year. All I'm saying is, if you actually invested £2 billion a year to get rid of the biggest bugbear for road users and the like, create jobs, apprenticeships, but a long-term investment, in fact, it would make economic sense, and it would a helping situation where people have, you know, lost their jobs through the pandemic, and it was spread jobs across the country.
Yeah. The trouble is, though, Mark, we've got a situation now where doing things for the motorists is not considered to be the right way to go, is it? Because we've heard, I think it was only last week, Grant Shapps' plan of a £27 billion spend on improving the roads network in this country has now been stymied, it would appear, by a load of green groups who have said, oh, no, you shouldn't be doing that because, of course, you know, you're going to be causing more pollution if more people are driving. But I always point out to people, by far and away, the biggest form of transport in this country is by vehicles, either cars or vans or lorries or buses or whatever it is. That's how most people get around. And therefore, the roads on which they drive must be in good shape, but they're not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we all get our goods and services through the road network. It is the blood supply of the UK economy. And I agree about the thing with the environmental impact. Mm. But if you look at cyclists, that survey we carried out, alarming figures, over 80% of cyclists are having to take dangerous evasive action because of potholes on the road.
Yeah.
We should be encouraging more cyclists. And they are at risk far more than you or me driving over a pothole in a vehicle. They're not assessed properly in terms of the risk to cyclists. So there's an argument there. Yes, and I think investment in technology, and I believe sort of hydrogen cars may be more of the answer than electric cars, because I don't think National Grid really could cope with the actual amount of us all plugging our cars at one time.
No.
Yes, and it needs a long-term plan. But these governments are very good at sound bites and bits of money. And I mean, I was involved in the Transport Select Committee, where a lot of MPs put a lot of work in and come up with a report about trying to improve our road network for all road users, not just motorists, all road users.
Yeah.
And we got lip service from the government, and that's set on the back burner. My view is, what's the point of having Transport Select Committees now? I'd never get involved in one again, because it's a whitewash in terms of things. Unless they put in a long-term plan with asset management and investment and improve standards. I mean, there is now a national training course for repairing potholes that wasn't there before that I was involved in developing. I think every guy that's out there should have to go through and be trained to do it, because
yeah.
we see the bucket of tar and shovel men far too many times.
Well, exactly right. And I mean, a number of times you also see, particularly around London, because obviously that's where I drive most of the time, the number of places where they're digging up roads and taking forever to do so, you can only really take the view that it's not about money. Certainly not here, it isn't. It's about trying to stop people from driving. You know, and I'm not going to agree with you about encouraging more people to cycle, I'm afraid, because we've got enough of them as it is. I'd like to see them cycling every day rather than just when it's nice weather, because as soon as the rain comes on or it gets a bit chilly, you know, the old Lycra Brigade are back in their cars.
Well, yeah, I mean, we should be encouraging cycling for people's health and benefits. I mean, if you look at other countries, don't get me on cyclists, because I would defend them because of the injuries, and actually I'd been involved with, when I've done some documentaries before, with people who've lost family.
I know it's very difficult. I know potholes are a particular problem for cyclists, and I get that. My tongue is slightly in my cheek before. But who's actually responsible, Mark, for filling in the potholes in any given place? Is it down to the local council?
Yeah, the Highways Authority for that area are responsible. They're not hard enough in terms of utilities that dig up roads and don't do the reinstatement to the correct standards. But Highways Authorities and councils have cut inspectors that should be policing it far more, because it's all been short-termism,
yeah.
rather than realising they can penalise them and fine them and things. I mean, it needs a real change. I mean, there's an attitude within sort of Highways Authorities, and even I think the central government's almost like they accept potholes, we can't do nothing about it, and we just do the best we can. And I don't accept that. I think you could do far more sensibly and use some smart techniques like thermal repairs that are not used enough, but there's no money in it for certain people who supply the tarmac. But I think unless you actually, we need a pothole czar to actually get in there and say to government, right, this is what you need to do. This is the plan going forward over the next 25 years, is get our roads back up to the standard they are, starting with asset management plans, including quality of works, badging work, and really shake it by the scruff of its neck and change things. Unless you do that, as much as I like coming on to talk radio and spoke to you, I'll be doing this till I go to the grave. But
hope we have slightly more influence than that, Mark. Listen, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. But maybe you should put yourself up for Pothole Czar. You seem to know more about it than most people that I talk to. Mark Morell, there, also known as Mr. Pothole, turned up in Parliament Square. Was it last year? In a tank, I think it was. to point out just how bad potholes actually are in this country. And if you drive around in any way which is more than occasionally, you will be held up, not just because there's a lot of traffic out there now, but also because most of the road systems that we have got a temporary... I mean, I would guarantee that on almost every journey you make now, you come across at least one temporary traffic light. And how often do you come to that temporary traffic light to find that one section of the road has been closed off, only then to find that nobody's actually there doing anything? They've closed it off, they put those orange and white fences up, or they put cones up, but there's nobody actually there fixing anything at all most of the time. It's an absolute disgrace, I tell you.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, let us, without further ado, take a trip to Brighton. Joel is a medical student there, where he is unusually able to go to lectures in person, physically, but many of his colleagues who are other students at other universities are not able to do so. He's with Stop the Student Rip-Off campaign. Joel, very good morning to you.
Morning, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much indeed. Tell us, first of all, about how much students are paying for the privilege of not being able to go to university, because I think that, first of all, kind of sums it all up, doesn't it?
So that's kind of the key thing. Students are paying, I mean, you said rightly, when the government changed the amount the university could charge, most of them went to 9,000 to 9,250. So you've got that cost you pay a year.
Right.
And then accommodation, other expenses come university, you're looking around another £6,000 to £9,000 as well. And you might get a maintenance loan to help with that. But in total, you're taking about 18K each year that either in debt that you're paying, and the times up by three for the average student, longer if you're doing a course like mine or other students. So you're edging towards, you know, to 40, 50, 60K in total for your 3 years. And this year, especially when you've not received anything like what you were promised or what you had in the year beforehand. And I think that's one of the reasons why we started the Stop Student Rip-Off campaign.
Yeah.
And tandem with a lot of other people who've been saying this for months, this isn't a new thing, but the government's just decided to basically say, it's up to universities and we'll ignore students and hope that it goes away.
Yeah.
And frankly, not going to go away because it's just not good enough.
That's the problem, isn't it, with government policy in which they believe things will go away. They just never do. They just get worse and worse and worse. A lot of people think, Joel, that at the time, back in September, students probably shouldn't have gone back because nobody's blaming them for it, but sending lots of young people around the country into, you know, halls of residence where they were going to be mingling quite closely together was never going to be a great idea for the control of a virus.
And I think that's really been the shocking thing, is whichever way you come down on that, either you say you shouldn't have sent them back and therefore they shouldn't have had to take up contracts for 12 months, they shouldn't have had to pay the fees. But it seems as if we were sent back on the hope that we'd pay the fees, say nothing about it. And when the inevitable happened, which was that we had to shut in-person teaching down and send students home or students were stuck on campus, then nothing's being done to remedy that. And that's the killer thing for us, is that if you've sent students back in and things have changed, fine, that might be outside of government control. Then it's up to the government, because their policies are the reason why now students find themselves locked into some of these contracts where they're paying for accommodation facilities that they don't use or they can't access. And that's just not good enough.
I don't think there's any doubt about the fact that the reason why the universities wanted you there in person was to basically take your money and the hell with the consequences. And I wonder how many people are in that situation where they have paid for 12 months or at least 9 months, the academic year, in either a hall of residence or in a private landlord accommodation situation. And what are they supposed to do? Because presumably, then none of them are there.
Yeah, and I mean, there are, what, 2.4 million students in the UK. 70% of us live in private accommodation, because after your first and second you've gone, you know, you're talking a huge millions of students who are in private accommodation, first of all, that we're told to come back. They're paying landlords, and either they're in two categories. Either they live so far away that for them, you know, they've come back because they didn't want to run the risk of paying for 12 months and not using anything, or they've gone back home so they can be close to their family, so their mental health doesn't suffer, etc. But then they're still paying for flats, for bills, for everything else that they don't use, and no one seems to be saying anything about that. Now, some universities, if you're in accommodation, have done. You know, we're trying to be fair on this. A few universities, I think Glasgow gave a 2-week refund, and Manchester Met gave a 2 weeks if you're isolating back. But 2 weeks out of a whole year
is
just a drop in the ocean compared to what university students are paying for their accommodation, let alone coming to the quality of education that they're paying for and not receiving at all.
Because one of the things that we've covered a lot on this show, of course, is you know, homeschooling and kids at school working from home. And a lot of teachers, a lot of head teachers I've spoken to say that there's no way you can substitute working from home and learning from home for actually being in a theatre or a lecture room or a classroom. And it could be as little as 20%. Retention of what you're actually learning. And also, you know, it's going to university is not about just sitting in lectures learning stuff, is it? It's about socializing, it's about being with other people, and sooner or later presumably you would wish that the government could put people back in physically to buildings.
Yeah, Mike, you make the best point, because actually it wasn't just teachers. If I remember last year and the years I've been in university, every time a student was sick or had to catch up and use online resources, the strapline you could ask any student was, online teaching is no substitute for in-person learning. Right. Over and over again, uses a stick kind of to beat students who, you know, had to go off sick, or, you know, maybe they were hungover and didn't turn up, whatever it was. We were always told until last September, online teaching is no substitute. And now suddenly it's equivalent. And therefore, you know, universities are saying, because the government said, oh, it's up to universities to decide if their education quality is good enough, and demands a refund because of it. And so it kind of seems, well, you told us for the last 5 years, online person is no substitute. Now you're saying avoid paying. Actually, it's good enough. We're meeting all our criteria. Stop talking to us. You don't need to discuss anything about it.
Yeah.
I think that's just, it's laughable. Really.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? Now, you're able to go to university in person, Joel, because you're a medical student. How is that a sort of decision been arrived at? And if you can do it, why can't everybody else?
So I think for me, the decision's been arrived at because our university, when you get to the clinical years, you're in hospital buildings and they're still open as essential places for learning and teaching. So actually where I am now is the medical school teaching library. And I'll give credit to my medical school. They've done their best to give a blend of in-person where we can, if it's spaced out, distance, et cetera. And there are loads of lecture theatres, you know, they're left lying empty on actual university campuses here at Sussex and Brighton. And so it does beg the question, if they can do it for us, why isn't there been a concerted effort? And I hope Boris Johnson in this speech on Monday and think plans he lays out will come up with a plan that's more than just saying, I'll wait till basically April and come back and see what happens. Is that actually, if we can do it for students like me, then perhaps there is a case for saying, well, we could have done it for other students. We haven't done it. And therefore, that's why this refund that the Stop the Student Ripoff campaign is you know, we're fighting for is so necessary, because we've not been given the quality that we were promised at the start of the year for many students.
And also your experience is entirely different, you know, from mine, for example. I mean, obviously, I went to university so long ago that not that many people used to go in those days. But I mean, you went there, you know, I'm glad to see that people are still getting drunk and missing lectures, because that's what we did a lot of. But, you know, the whole the idea of this sort of, you know, lockdown is that it's not good for younger people, particularly because, you know, we've done an awful lot of stuff. I mean, I talk to Neil Oliver, the TV presenter, every week, and he was saying, you know, I've been around the world, I've been to lots of places, I've got kids, I've done lots of different jobs, but you guys need to be out there, you know, experiencing things.
And it's, you know, no university in their prospectuses before this pandemic was saying, we just do teaching. Their main sell was, we give you the social experience, we give you the, you know, unique work experience, we give you the experience on campuses, we give you so much more. They were all about their added value more than teaching. And so it seems flies in the face of that for them to say, well, as long as we meet the teaching criteria, then we're giving university experience. It's not the same. It's not what students expected. And, you know, to just turn around and say, oh, it's that it's equivalent, and because it's a pandemic, we get it. Most students, you know, understand that, you know, we can't have things exactly as they are. But to not even try and attempt it, and for the government to pat this around, it's kind of, we're being paid pass the parcel with, where, you know, the government says, oh, it's not for us, go to the Office of Students. The Office of Students says, oh, you're autonomous universities, we advise you to do this, but, you know, we can't really do anything. And, you know, a lot of people have been taken in by that and think there's nothing you can do. But I remember George Osborne able to retrospectively change, you know, the fees status in 2016. So the government does have the power to do that. And to say that they can't, or, you know, they're leaving it to universities, I think it's just shirking their responsibilities and, you know, not living up to the standards that they themselves, when Boris Johnson was telling students to return and the university was saying it was safe to return, have done. They've just kind of, you know, they're really saying one thing and doing another, and it's not really good enough for many students.
There's no way the government can now hide behind any form of legality where they say, oh, no, we can't change that, because they've changed so much over the course of the last year, including inventing a new crime, you know, filling out a form wrong, for which you can be fined £10,000 or go to jail for 10 years, you know. Mm. So there's no way that they can't change anything if they want to. Have you got any specific kind of set of demands, as it were, Joel? I mean, what are you asking for?
Yeah, so the three demands are essentially, we've said the first demand is to have a third off, so a third reduction in fees, and that should be given back to students as a refund this year. The second demand is to do better, and there are loads of people who have strategies about the piecemeal mental health provision that's been given to students. Uh-huh. One of the biggest things that's been so sad to see for myself and many students who I've spoken to before I came on this was just how badly the support is for them at this moment in time. People are saying, you know, you send an email for an appointment to speak to someone, et cetera. It takes a few weeks. You know, you go on back through this process. Students, you know, committing suicide, students are depressed. Studies have shown this throughout that that's happened. And we really think more needs to be done now rather than waiting, because there was already an epidemic of student mental health problems. And I think that's only going to get worse. And then the third demand is also kind of a smaller one, but to reduce the interest rate that students pay on their student loans.
Right.
And we kind of got to this first demand of a third off, because if you consider what students are being given now, it's equivalent to what the Open University does. They say you fit your studies around your life. They're not selling you know, the student experience. They're selling you the teaching online, and that's what they've always done. And that costs around 2/3 of the cost of a full-time degree and the full degree that universities offer. So it's only fair to that equivalent standard to say, well, then students this year definitely deserve that third off the fees that they've paid.
That seems fair. Because also, I mean, you always have a little bit of a drop-off rate from people who decided the course is not for them. But I imagine if you're sitting at home in your parents' house that you were desperately trying to get away from, wondering whether this is ever going to end, you might think, you know what, I'm going to try and actually get a job instead.
Mm. And you can't do that. And you're facing so many financial burdens, whether, you know, you're an international student who has your fees really high, and so you're not covered if the government changes legislation, or, you know, you want to work because, you know, you're paying £600 a month for a house you don't live in and you want to help out in some way, you can't do that. I think there are so many financial burdens that students, whether they're rich or poor, are facing. And I think it's not a case of starting to say, as the government said, oh, individual cases. There needs to be a blanket kind of, you know, here, this has not been the good standard of education or the standard that you had last year. Mm. No one who was at university last year can say this is anything different. Tutors are trying their best. Again, I'm trying to give credit where it's due. Some tutors have gone above and beyond, but across the board, we're seeing that this is not the same standard of university that we were expecting or we were told that we would have. And therefore, I think it's only right that they start to make plans to refund us at least a third of our university fees.
Yeah, because that's a good point that you raise about overseas students. I mean, if you came here from another country only to find out that the university was basically shutting down and you were told to go home, have they all had to go back to their home countries?
It depends, because, I mean, it depends on the country you're coming from and also whether the risk of you coming back in, because we obviously the UK didn't have travel restrictions really until this year. So when that starts to come in, you then have to think as a student in this term, if I go home over Christmas, will I be allowed back in? And if I have to spend, I think, I don't know too much about the visa situation, but I think there's a requirement to spend certain amounts of time in the UK as part of your years of university and term to meet the requirements. So then you run the risk, as an international student especially, and I've spoken to a few of them, of, well, I want to go home for Christmas and I'm in a country that's fine to let me come in, but then will I be able to come back to the UK afterwards? And so most of them don't take the risk, or a lot of them don't bother, because, you know, it's just too dangerous for them to say, I'm going to go home and come back. And I think there's so many areas, if you look at people's situations, where there's so many things, it's just not thought out. Mike, I think the problem for me is the government put this policy in, and obviously the lockdown, you can argue whether it was good or bad or whatever about that, but if you put a policy in, you should think about what the consequences are of that. And they seem to have just put the policy in, thought nothing about the consequences, how to mitigate them, and then seem surprised when students and other groups say, you know, this isn't good enough and we want something done. It's almost like, how dare you? And a lot of us are stunned, saying, well, this was always going to happen. Sage said in October, I think they said, the adverse consequence of online teaching will be a drop in students' mental health. It was very clear that that was going to happen, and seems to be nothing coming from the government, bar the odd statement here or there. We're doing what we can. We've put funding for students to do this, etc. Now make it all go away. And that's frankly not good enough.
No, quite. And at least, Joel, you've got you're preparing and being trained for something which is a tangible kind of job that you're going to be doing sooner rather than later, presumably. An awful lot of students are kind of just doing a degree. They don't really know what it is they're going to do. And for many of them, I would imagine, they're beginning to question whether that's a good idea.
Yeah, I think this has really revealed a kind of wider topic, which is probably something we won't have time to discuss in the current pandemic, something going to be afterwards, about the value of university and the value of the teaching you receive. Because, I mean, if you're receiving 10 hours a week and paying $9,000, you might be thinking now, even if that goes back to in-person next year, is that really good value for money? Will my course get me the job prospects, the money back that I want to earn the salary? And that's a wider conversation. I think many students are starting to see themselves more as consumers rather than beforehand, where I think a lot of us just kind of went to university because it was a thing to do and it was an extension of our education. Now they're realizing we signed contracts, we pay this money, we borrow from the government in most cases to afford it, but still we are consumers. We've got a service that we were told we would be provided, and that's not being done. And it's I think it's baffling when I said 2.4 million students, that's a big sector for nothing really to be done about. I mean, I saw the CMA have done work on what holidaymakers, what people who are doing weddings should do about if you don't get the services you were paying for because of coronavirus, you get a refund. But it doesn't seem to be any specific advice tailored to the 2.4 million students in the UK. And I think that's a big number of people just to ignore, whether personally or politically for the government, I think they're making a big mistake.
Yes, of course. And all of those students have got parents who vote and you vote and everything else. So listen, good luck with it, Joel. We shall be pressing your case the next time we get somebody on from the government. We'll make sure they know that you want something done and we'll do our best to get it done for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. Now, we haven't done much homeschooling this week, partly because it's been half term, of course. And so, generally speaking, most of the children of the country have had a little bit of time off because they've spent so much time staring into computers. It's been a bit difficult for them. And I have great sympathy for every parent who's been trying to homeschool their kids over the course of the last several weeks and months, because it's quite difficult, particularly as they get older, and in some cases when they're younger as well, because they can't just be doing it unsupervised. But I'm delighted to say we're joined today by lexicographer, language historian Susie Dent, great podcaster as well. Susie, a very good afternoon to you.
Afternoon, Mike. Lovely to see you.
No, thank you for coming back on again. Now, we're celebrating multiculturalism. Multilingualism today.
Yes.
I saw multi and immediately just put the second word on it by mistake. Because apparently loads of people have learned another language this year, which is great news, isn't it?
It's fantastic news. And it's just such a staggering statistic. So this was research done by Rosetta Stone, the language learning app. Yeah. And it said 3.3 million more of us have actually mastered another language in the last year, which is just, you know, phenomenal.
It is.
And really great as well, because let's face it, it's been such a tough time, and I know we've turned our hands to sourdough and, you know, running and spring cleaning and that kind of thing, but we've obviously just thought, what is my aspiration? I've always wanted to learn another language, and now's the time.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because normally speaking, British people are very well known for not being very good at talking in a different language. I mean, we've got lots of different people from different countries in our country, all of whom speak pretty good English. And yet when we go abroad, it's pretty pathetic, isn't it, normally?
Yes, it is. And kind of embarrassingly so. But I think particularly in the younger generations, I mean, there was a real spike, I think, in the 25 to 44 year olds. There was a huge increase in those who have actually gone on a language learning app and not only just started, but actually become fluent, which just is testimony to the technology we have available now. So I think there's a real desire out there actually to not be complacent and not just rely on spell checkers and handheld voice recognition things, and to actually, you know, immerse ourselves in another culture.
It is kind of ironic, I suppose, that we can't actually go anywhere to practice this new language that we've learned, but hopefully that will come in the next weeks and months. What's the main sort of top language that people have been learning?
I think, well, Spanish is almost near the top of the list, and it's been there for quite a long time. And that's the one I have been trying to tackle at home myself using Rosetta Stone, in fact. And it's been a real escape for me. So, yes, as you say, we can't actually go there ourselves at the moment. But it's just you can travel. You can have a sort of holiday in your mind, if you like. It's been a really lovely bit of escapism because you see these lovely visuals of places in Spain and you hear the rhythms and the sounds of the language that kind of wash over you, and it's been great. But we've also apparently been trying Arabic, Korean, Japanese, so you know, trying other scripts as well. Russian is one that I would love to turn my hands at, and I'd obviously have to master Cyrillic there. But
I was gonna say, you know, can you learn a language kind of phonetically, if you like, rather than actually knowing? Because particularly if you're looking at, say, Japanese or Mandarin or Russian, where you've got a different alphabet. I mean, even Greek. I mean, I remember going to Greece. I mean, in most countries of Europe, I can figure out the menu, but when it's written in Greek, obviously I can't, you know.
No, but it's never too late to try it, Mike, honestly. And I worked with Rachel Riley on Countdown, who is married to a Russian, and she mastered Cyrillic really quickly.
Really?
Using a language learning app. Yeah. So, you know, whereas probably when we were at school, it was very much kind of rote learning, based on rote learning a lot of the time. You know, there were certainly things like Linguaphone out there where you could listen, but they weren't interactive. Whereas the ones these days actually brilliantly kind of test how you pronounce things and then very gently kind of nudge you in the right direction if you don't quite get it right. And then you get a real sense of achievement once you've finished a particular module.
Well, there's no doubt that practice is what you need. I mean, whenever I go, I mean, my French is probably the best of the languages that I speak. And if I do go to France, by the time I've been there a couple of days, I've certainly remembered an awful lot more of the words that I learned, albeit that I started learning when I was in secondary school.
Yeah, that's totally true. And it's definitely a muscle that you can tone up. You know, it might have got a bit slack over time, but it's definitely still there. And language learning has been proven to help with memory and concentration and creativity even as well. But not only that, but with French, as you'll know, Mike, you can really start to decode your own language as well and have a better appreciation of the threads between the different languages. And that always just gives me a thrill when I see a connection that I had no idea existed. You know, it's a brilliant trail to follow.
Oh, absolutely right. My problem with looking at sort of, you know, I don't know, videos and sounds and scenes of foreign countries is I start to get grumpy because I'm not there. I mean, last week I was looking at a map and feeling sort of, you know, homesick for traveling. I started sort of following this map across to France and then down into Spain and remembered the road that I'd driven, you know, from Cadaquet up through this French border and into the south of France, you know. And, you know,
there's a brilliant German word for that, actually, homesickness for travel, which is, it's like the pain is called faraway pain and it's Fernweh.
Oh, that's
good.
It's
like far sickness, which is just gorgeous.
Yes, I like that a lot. It's like Schadenfreude, isn't it? It's that German, but there is no other proper word for that apart from the German one. And so, I mean, I'm hoping that we'll be all able to travel fairly soon. What about your own journey? I mean, are you what language do you feel most confident in now then?
Well, I've actually, because I did German and French at university and they were my first loves, really. And so I've actually been using the app to actually improve my German skills as well, because, you know, that's probably lain dormant for a very long time. And strangely, German for me, even though I've got no family connection there, whenever I start speaking it or hearing it, I feel like I'm going home or coming home. It's a really lovely kind of connection that I don't fully understand, but it's really important to me. So it doesn't just have to be a new language. I think you can go back to the ones like you with your French that you have, you know, a fairly good grounding in, and then actually just brush it up all over again. And you get thrill a second time.
And the survey that I've got in front of me here says that more people think now that language learning should be compulsory at GCSE level. It should really, shouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it was back in 2004 that it fell off. And I don't think it ever should have fallen off, actually, because there's so much to be gained, as we've said, from learning and understanding another culture. Mm. And kids love it. You know, I went to a primary school a couple of years ago where the kids were learning Mandarin. There were German speakers in there. There were Spanish speakers and French speakers. And they were just awash with all these languages. And they knew words in every single one of them. Their brains were so kind of malleable.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic to see. And many of the apps that you can use, including Rosetta Stone, in fact, they emulate the way that kids learn language, that it's much more immersive. It's not just sort of sitting down in front of a text, but you are immersed in the sounds. You can see the things written down as well. And it's just a really, really productive approach.
Yes. And for anyone who's ever stood anywhere in a foreign country wondering what on earth is going on, I mean, that's enough of an incentive in itself, isn't it? Where you go, I knew what these people were saying to me.
Yeah, no, you know, I was thinking, I've learnt two fantastic words that I think sum up the sort of culture. One is a very strange Finnish word that, for me, only the Finns could have. I think it's fallen out of use now, but it's an old measurement of distance of, I think, about 8 kilometres, and it's poronkusuma, and it translates as reindeer pee, because it's the amount of distance a reindeer can travel without having to urinate, which I think is brilliant.
And presumably depends on the age of the reindeer.
I suppose that's true. And also in Italian, it was like a passeggiata, which is just a Sunday afternoon stroll, but it's so much more than that.
I love Italian. Yes. Italian's great.
It is beautiful, isn't it? But it's a stroll where you actually physically go out to meet people, and it's right. A real institution. And you couldn't understand that, I think, without learning the word and the story behind it.
No, brilliant. Susie, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Susie Dent there.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
It's Friday, it's 12:48, and it's time for this.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Perrier Awards.
Delighted to see full compliance, 100% compliance today. First time, I think, possibly this year.
Well, I've told them that if they didn't comply, I was going to take their titles away.
Quite right, too.
So,
well done.
I'm pleased to announce that you still remain working members of the Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
You haven't fired them.
No, not yet.
Not yet.
There's always next Friday.
There's always next Friday. Very good. Welcome.
Welcome, and thank you.
Yes.
And good afternoon, and welcome again. To the Perrier Awards, this is where we look back over the past week of the so-called Independent Republic
so
of
cool.
Mike Graham on
yes.
Talk Radio and choose our favourite moments. As it's tradition, Mike, the first Perrier goes to you.
Excellent.
This time is a classic. It's the rant of the week.
Because we have to get away from the geeks. It has to be done. The geeks do not rule us. We will not be ruled by geeks. It's that simple. I'm not against geeks generally. I just don't want them telling me what to do. That's fair enough, isn't it?
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it is. So geeks.
So geek backlash.
Yes. So not nerds.
No.
Not dorks.
Not dorks. No.
Geeks.
Specifically, yes.
Okay.
I think nerds are specifically computer nerds.
Ah.
Whereas geeks can be any kind of technocrats.
It's like a generic.
Yeah, I think
term
so. I think so. And also a dork is more sort of, I would say, dismissive.
Ah.
For somebody who's not very good at something.
Fair enough.
Whereas geek, I think, you know,
yeah,
encapsulates.
I mean, they're very good at what they do, to be fair, what they're trying to do. They're
conning
doing
everybody.
Well. Yeah,
yeah,
they're doing well.
Right.
Caller Richard in Manchester wins a Perrier for the insult of the week.
Mm. It's very interesting, and you, as an ex-journalist up there, might be able to get a full... It would be very interesting.
It's a bit harsh.
To get
I mean, I'm still a journalist, to be fair, Richard. I'm not an ex-journalist.
I'm sorry.
He was sorry.
He was sorry.
Yeah.
He was also wrong.
He was.
Bless.
That's all right.
But, you know.
Thank you, Richard.
Yeah. Obviously, when I say insult, I don't mean insult.
No. Also, I get insulted all the time. I can take it.
Well, I was going to say, you've probably been called worse than ex-journalist.
It's true. I have.
So,
even this morning.
Yeah, we won't go into that one. We now look back to Monday evening. During the Downing Street COVID press conference, the Prime Minister won a Perrier for the pronunciation of the week.
What's the name of that drug again, Chris?
Tocilizumab.
Say again?
Tocilizumab.
We're going to get this right. Is it Tocilizumab?
Near enough, PM.
Something like that. Okay, this is the one we got to get. We got to make sure we get this right.
Tocilizumab.
Tocilizumab. There you go. Okay, we're going to have to know that as well as we know dexamethasone. Tocilizumab, folks. That's the one.
I think that's a good definition of Boris Johnson's premiership, isn't it?
Yes.
Near enough. That'll do.
That's very good.
Near enough.
Yeah, close enough. Let's move on. Yeah. To be fair, it's a very tricky word, and Mike Graham himself also won a Perry for the pronunciation of the week.
Tocilizumab. No. What? I could say it before, right? Tocilizumab. Tocilizumab. Anyway. Oh, well. Yeah, because I was able to do it before that.
You did.
And then when I deliberately tried to do it again.
Yeah.
And it was spelled in front of me. I still couldn't
do it. I must say, like, the first time when you got it right, I was a bit disappointed. Because
I
was like, hey, free content.
I know.
Which didn't come my way. So
don't worry.
I always appreciate when you say all these things wrong.
Yes.
What was it?
Tocilizumab. I think I said it.
Tocilizumab.
See, it's not even spelled in front of me. Tocilizumab.
No, there's no second bubub. It's
Tocilizumab. Is that like Beelzebub? The master of darkness.
That's from the Bible, isn't it?
Yeah, Beelzebub's the devil.
Yeah, yeah. Beelzebub.
Don't ever...
That's how I learned it in Spanish.
How do you say it?
Beelzebub.
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 That's nice. Sounds like a tapas dish.
Well, we're talking about learning other languages,
yeah.
So that's the word
Very
of the day.
Good. Like
hey.
It.
Now, off to the visual peril of the week.
This is new for anyone who's watching us on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter. Sorry if you're not, but get on it because it's great fun.
Yes, correct. Talk Radio Evening's presenter James Well made it to the papers for ranting so hard he injured himself. Mm. Here's what happened.
Who has got to Boris? Who? Which flipping stupid scientist has got to Boris and told him that pubs and restaurants there, those places were the least likely to I've bitten my flipping tongue now.
He's lucky he didn't swear there.
I was going to say that was also the almost swear word of the week that
Very
never happened.
Very close run thing.
James came on the show yesterday. Bless him. He's got a sense of humour.
He has. Yeah.
I called him in the morning. I was like, look, we just want to take the mickey out of you a little bit. And he was, you know.
He was very good.
He was happy to talk to us.
He was injured.
And for this reason, for being such a good sport, surprise, surprise, this is not the only visual parody this week. There is another one. And it's also for James Well for something that we love on this show. It's the animal interruption of the week.
I haven't got quite as good a shirt, though, as James has tonight.
Do you like my shirt? It's almost worth tuning in to see my shirt, isn't it, really? Oh, Daisy, shush.
Set the dogs
Sorry, it's Daisy.
set the dogs in.
What's wrong with my shirt?
What's right with it?
Dear, oh dear.
That sounds like a vicious dog.
Yes.
The growling.
I just think the dog doesn't like the shirt.
Maybe.
That's,
well, nobody does.
That's what it is.
I mean, nobody likes that shirt.
It's a Ben Fletcher shirt, isn't it?
It is, kind of,
For
yeah.
people not familiar with Ben Fletcher,
yes.
he's the... News sports reader,
yes.
formerly of Talk Radio and Our Talk Sport,
yes.
and he's the voice on the Parrot Awards jingle.
Oh, is he?
Yes,
oh,
he's
I didn't
the
know
voice.
That.
Yeah,
I didn't
that's
know
Ben
that.
Fletcher.
Well,
anyway,
he does wear a loud shirt. He likes a loud shirt.
I think loud is very generous.
Mm.
He likes a shirt.
Yes,
and that's how I'm going to leave it.
Okay,
because I don't want conflicts with
and
anyone.
And James likes a loud shirt and tie. Funnily enough,
does he?
He has all his ties behind him.
Oh yeah, but he doesn't wear them.
Well, occasionally he does, I think.
Does he?
Yeah.
Oh well.
Mm.
I'll keep looking.
Keep looking.
Keep a closer look.
Yes.
It's now time to check with travel guru Simon Calder. You both win a joint Perry for the missing question of the week.
We'll do what you can to get out of it.
Mm.
Crikey, and we're on to question three, which I can't even remember what it is now.
No, neither can I. So let's move on to question four.
That's what happens when you ask too many questions.
Exactly right. Yeah, well, there is an art to asking questions, isn't there?
Yeah.
They say never ask a question that you don't know the answer to, which is not entirely true in my case.
No.
I do sometimes ask questions that I don't know the answer to.
Well, but that's good, because then that's how you learn.
That's why you're asking.
I think the key is not to ask questions that are so long that they don't seem questions anymore.
That's
they turn into monologues and people don't know what to say to
them.
That's
a very good point.
But you don't do that.
No, I try
so
not
we're
to.
Fine.
No.
And finally, our friend in the afternoons, Ian Collins, who I think is waiting to come in.
He will be here
And
shortly.
This is going to resonate with you because something similar happened as an incident earlier on this show.
Yes.
He wins a Perry for the sound effect of the week.
I was watching your programme earlier. That would never have been for... Did it sound like somebody honked a horn behind me then for a second? That's my squeaky chair. Yes.
The chair does squeak.
It does squeak.
But it didn't today, did it?
It did,
really?
Yeah. Didn't you see us laughing at one
no.
point?
Well, I see you laughing all the time. I just assume you're laughing at me saying something ridiculous.
No, something happened. You asked the question and then the chair squeaked.
Oh, I didn't hear
and
it.
And then, oh, I thought you'd noticed.
No, I didn't hear it. Sorry.
Well, there you go.
But, I mean, it's not too much to ask, is it? I mean, we've got the most beautiful studio here, you know, high above the Thames, views of Tower of London, you know, high tech everywhere, video, audio. You know,
everything. We've got
but
everything.
We can't find a chair that doesn't squeak.
I'll tell you what, so that squeaky chair used to be in the control room.
Oh, somebody shifted it.
Somebody, yes.
Well.
And I'm suspicious of someone.
I'm going to have words, I think, with the management.
I think we should.
Get them to replace the chair. The silent chair should be in here.
Yes.
You can
yes.
have a squeaky chair in it. Nobody cares.
Well, I don't want a squeaky chair.
Yeah,
though.
But it doesn't matter, though, if you have.
Matters to me.
Well, it doesn't to me. I'm going to have to have words.
All right, then.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, because that's all for the Perrier Awards. There'll be more next week.
The Perrier Awards on Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1 Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.